Hello and welcome everybody to Making Public Health Personal. This podcast is brought to you by the CUNY Graduate School of Public Health and Health Policy in New York City. I'm your host, Laura Mioli Farragon. Thanks for listening. Today's episode is about the consensus among almost 400 experts to provide specific recommendations to end COVID-19 as a public health threat. The Delphi study was published in Nature, the world's leading multidisciplinary science journal. It features specific actions unanimously recommended by a panel of public health experts from 112 countries and territories. We'll discuss the process for coordinating this type of study, the major areas it addresses, and the practical tips that you can take to protect yourself from COVID-19 no matter where you live in the world. Speaking with us today are three colleagues from CUNY SPH from this global panel who I'll introduce you to. This panel is led by CUNY SPH senior scholar Jeffrey Lazarus. He is the head of the Health Systems Research Group and the co-director of the Viral and Bacterial Infections Program at the Barcelona Institute for Global Health and an associate professor at the University of Barcelona. His decade-long career as a health systems, HIV, and viral hepatitis expert at WHO's Regional Office for Europe was followed by 3 years at the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria. He currently serves as co-chair of the HIV Outcomes Beyond Viral Suppression Coalition and as a member of several other public health committees worldwide. Next is the Dean of CUNY SPH and co-chair of the panel, Dr. Ayman El Mohandez. He is a pediatrician, public health academic, and researcher with a deep commitment to public service and community engagement. He is chairman of the board for the Association for Schools and Programs in Public Health in the United States and co-lead of the New York City Pandemic Response Institute. Dr. El Mohandez has been actively engaged in the response to COVID-19 here in New York City and around the world through an ongoing tracking survey monitoring the experiences and perspectives of New York City residents. He is also collaborating with an international consortium to assess and respond to COVID-19 vaccine hesitancy worldwide. Finally, we have study methodologist and co-author Dr. Diana Romero. She is a professor in the Department of Community Health and Social Sciences, and she directs CUNY SPH's specialization on maternal, child, reproductive, and sexual health. Dr. Romero's research has focused on reproductive and sexual health, social policies related to the health of poor and low-income populations, and healthcare access among underserved populations, utilizing mixed methods. Jeff, Ayman, and Diana, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you.
So aside from the immunocompromised who continue to be vigilant, it seems as if society is back to normal, I say that with air quotes, in terms of the way things were pre-pandemic. President Biden even mentioned recently that the pandemic is over. Now, do we think it's over or is this wishful thinking? Ayman?
There is no question that as the pandemic has lingered with its associated threats to the global economy and the national economy, many sources have tried to impress upon the population that the pandemic is over. I think the incentive behind that is to encourage people to return to normalcy in terms of their productivity, their travel, etc. But there is a significant risk in making that assumption. First of all, it is not true. There are many new cases that are diagnosed on a daily basis, and there are recorded deaths that are occurring that actually exceed the deaths associated with influenza. And as such, we cannot say that the pandemic is over. It is actually misleading. We need to say that there are many new factors that may modify the response to the pandemic, but that we should remain vigilant, monitoring these important factors such as vaccination and boosters, but also monitoring data points that should be predictive of where we are with the pandemic, including transmissibility, new cases, hospitalizations, and deaths. So the assumption that the pandemic is over may interfere or impede the vigilance of monitoring such data, disseminating the results of such data, and the national response, the public's response, or attention to this data and its importance, as well as other informational and communication messages that are going out to the public.
So it sounds like this is a rapidly changing situation. What is being recommended and why? Jeff?
What the panel of almost 400 experts from 112 countries and territories recommended was that we take a whole of society approach, a whole of government approach, a vaccines plus approach. Those are three of the main recommendations of 57 recommendations where there was consensus. And so really what the panel is saying is that one control measure at a time is not going to work. And we've seen that failing. We've seen that vaccines alone don't work. Mm-hmm. Face masks alone don't work. One government entity, one government body, one government ministry alone can't handle what is a societal issue, which is more of a global issue and not just a health issue. You know, you asked also about, you know, if the pandemic is over. Of course, we'd like to say it's over, but when variants of concern or principal variant of concern, Omicron, is still circulating, while there are still mutations, while there's still so much uncertainty, coupled with, you know, the high numbers of infections, still excess mortality, and now the new pandemic, which is long COVID, having symptoms lasting over 28 days, we can't say the pandemic is over. We're in a much, much better space than we were in before. And we recognize that in the Nature consensus statement, but we make a set of recommendations to do something that the governments, world leaders, multilateral organizations failed to do, which was to have a comprehensive action plan and strategy. And that's still the case. And therefore, as technical leaders in the area, we've tried to help the political leaders and provide them with the key recommendations that need to be implemented at different times and in different ways, depending on the context, in order to bring this pandemic to an end as a public health threat.
So what are the unanimous short-term and then long-term recommendations?
Well, some of those unanimous or almost unanimous recommendations are the whole of society approach, whole of government approach, and the vaccines plus approach that I mentioned. There was a large amount or a large degree of agreement on most recommendations. And Dr. Romero can speak to this because it's a multi-stage process in which we're refining recommendations in order to reach a higher degree of agreement, but that the recommendations still have teeth. So we don't water them down, but we do try and see where there are areas of disagreement and how that could possibly be overcome. And what's really unique in this process is that we present where there is disagreement, because that's also been one of the problems in addressing the pandemic. We don't share where there's disagreement among experts, among leaders. And where there is disagreement, we know there's poorer implementation of the measures, poorer adherence on the part of the population.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Diana?
Yeah, I would add to what Dr. Lazarus said, highlighting a few of the sort of top recommendations. One certainly having to do with pandemic inequities and the panels recognizing that there were longstanding pre-existing inequities across, you know, different groups of society, social determinants of health. And one of the key recommendations was that without addressing those pre-existing inequities, that addressing I'm responding to any kind of public health threat, whether it's COVID at the moment or future threats, will continue to be really difficult and hit certain groups more so than others. So that certainly was another, I think, key recommendation. And then this notion of whole of government and whole of society, there were recommendations that went, you know, sort of a step further to talk about how intersectoral and intergovernmental cooperation was needed, you know, in terms of trade agreements and the like, so that necessary items can be more easily transported and shared and redistributed. So I think that because it's a pandemic, that was a really important element as well.
So you hit on an important point about inequities. How can COVID-19 be addressed on a global scale? Ayman?
When we are talking about inequities, we are not only talking about low and middle income countries, but it is definitely our experience that even within the industrialized world, there have been pockets, populations with low socioeconomic reserve and poorly represented and culturally underrepresented that have suffered a great burden from this disease. There needs to be a global initiative where countries acknowledge that we are in this together. And if some countries are behind in vaccination or are experiencing outbreaks, that there will be global consequences. There hasn't been a time where the significance of a global response has been felt in a more direct and more relevant way. And as such, we hope that organizations such as the WHO, but inter-country agreements also, allow for this important area of inequity to be addressed. But it's not only about resources, but it's also about communication. And I think that the world has suffered tremendously in setbacks, especially in response to the vaccine, adopting other vaccine plus approaches and mandates where misinformation was disseminated widely. And I think one of the important aspects of this consensus is a level of humility in our understanding how important it is to reach down to the grassroots level, engage communities, take into consideration cultural elements, work with opinion leaders and community leaders and advocates towards formulating cultural messaging and also the better understanding of the vehicles of dissemination and remaining extremely vigilant to misinformation that's being disseminated, which has set us back in a very significant way. Unfortunately, this is not a problem that we are suffering from uniquely in our country, but has been also a problem that has been experienced globally.
Absolutely. And I think early on in the pandemic, we heard a lot about herd immunity, but it seems that we're not really hearing about that anymore. Why is that? Jeff?
We've moved on from a discussion about herd immunity because earlier we thought that this vaccine would function like other vaccines, like the measles vaccine, in which case, when you reached a certain level of protection in the community, the likelihood of onward transmission would be so low that we could talk about community or herd immunity. Now, these vaccines have been proven to be extremely effective, but they're effective at preventing severe symptoms, hospitalization, and death. By doing that, they also reduce transmission, but they don't eliminate transmission. So there's always a risk that even if vaccinated, you can get infected. The likelihood of that happening is low or lower with the vaccine. The likelihood of severe symptoms is much lower with the vaccine, but it means that transmission continues. And while transmission continues, we need a vaccines plus approach. So we also improve ventilation and air filtration and use face masks in crowded indoor settings or public transportation. And when most of us do three or four different things, then the likelihood of transmission reduces and hopefully becomes eliminated as a public health threat. In its absence, we risk continued mutations and we risk a variant of interest or a variant of concern. And the concern with the new possible variants of concern is that there'll be a greater level of vaccine escape or immune escape in which the vaccines will be less effective or maybe much less effective, leaving people very vulnerable to the virus. And that's why we say the pandemic, you know, is not over at this stage.
So as COVID-19 keeps mutating and there's new variants and new boosters, it sounds like we might need a new shot every year, like the flu. Is that the case? Or do we keep monitoring that to see how it goes?
We keep monitoring the situation. It's even possible we'll need a vaccine more than every year. We need a flu vaccine every year. For other vaccines, we need a booster maybe after 10 years or less. There's medications that we sometimes need to take every 8 hours, people who have taken paracetamol or ibuprofen. So, I mean, we need to put this into perspective and say that, you know, in the face of a deadly pandemic, if we need to get vaccinated once a year or a few times more a year, given the health benefits, the societal benefits, the economic benefits, it's not a big ask. We'd like to have a long-lasting vaccine, and that was one of the recommendations of the Nature panel. So the private sector, together with the public sector, needs to work hard to develop vaccines that are longer lasting and that can be even more responsive to new variants.
Ayman, did you want to add anything?
There is no question that early on in the pandemic, there was a large infusion of capital, both from federal government sources as well as private sources, towards the development of the vaccine. And our experience with this has been that although there was perhaps upwards of $14 billion investment from the federal government in the United States, that the cost savings by preventing new infections and mitigating the pandemic's onslaught on the economy and on the population in our country, the benefits are almost tenfold the investments in the vaccine itself. But it's important for us also to take stock at this moment and think that this investment should not stop. There are new technologies that can be developed. There are many aspects of the vaccine that are challenging, as you mentioned, whether it covers all the variants or not, the fact that it has to be administered every 6 months or less, which is not very practical to many people. Maybe we can produce a vaccine that is coupled with, for example, the flu shot, which people are accustomed to taking and would reduce the burden of having to take multiple vaccines. And then finally, as you are well aware, some of the vaccines that are available require a very high level of vigilance in transportation and storage at very low temperatures. Perhaps as time goes on, we can produce vaccines that are easier to disseminate to healthcare providers, make them more easily available at primary healthcare sites with less requirements in terms of storage that can make it easier for people to get the vaccine. We've also found out in some of the polls that we conducted that people prefer to get the vaccine at their primary healthcare provider or at their local pharmacy than they are to get them elsewhere. So making that accessible and easier to make available is a very important step for the future.
Definitely. And having a young baby myself, I can tell you that having to get three doses for a baby and have them at separate times from the other vaccines that they need is very difficult to schedule. So hopefully in the future, they'll be able to couple them with other shots that they need.
Absolutely.
If you dream of making a difference in the world, a public health degree or certificate can give you the tools to do just that. The City University of New York's Graduate School of Public Health and Health Policy equips public health professionals to advance not only a healthier New York City, but a healthier world for us all. We want you to join us in our mission. Visit sph.cuny.edu to learn more about our programs. No matter where you are in your career, CUNY SPH offers a broad range of degree and certificate programs to not only help you advance in your career, but to have a real impact on the world. Public health professionals are needed now more than ever. Join us. Visit sph.cuny.edu to learn more.
So Jeff spoke about the different approaches, not just vaccines, but ventilation. What about mask mandates? Do we bring those back, or is that something that the panel is recommending?
I think there will always be a place for masking. And it's very important to realize that people have to be responsive as changes occur. For example, a larger number of cases in a community has been detected, a higher level of transmissibility has been detected. That might influence recommendations related to masking. At the current moment, we know that masking is protective, especially in crowded places, crowded indoor places. During transportation, for example, that masking is recommended. There will be perhaps a loosening of some of these restrictions in situations where transmission is low and the cases reported are low. But to presume that this is a road of no return, meaning if we are not masking today, it means that we will not be masking next week is unrealistic. And so where it comes to masking, I think we need to be very, very aware of what is happening around us. If we have an outbreak, the concentration of cases and the transmissibility of a new variant, for example, that can influence that behavior. But in the meantime, I think caution indicates that in indoor crowded environments, masking is a very valuable addition to the armamentarium of various preventive measures.
Jeff, did you want to add something?
Yeah, to answer your question, the panel does not call for mandatory masking. It, as mentioned, presents using face masks as part of a comprehensive response. And remember, when we focus just on face masks, it's a very polemic issue. It also shifts responsibility to the individual. Not everyone can afford high quality face masks, so we need to make them easily available. And we need to remember that there are roles governments and employers and others can play, as mentioned earlier, through improved ventilation, air filtration, through longer lasting vaccines, through helping people get vaccinated in the community when they can't reach healthcare centers, or, you know, helping them with their opportunity or real out-of-pocket costs when they do need to take transportation to get vaccinated. So I don't think it's so helpful to focus on just that one issue. In Spain, where I'm working as well, we have mandatory face masks on public transportation, so on the buses and trains and metro. Very few people use the face masks on public transportation, and that leaves, you know, the vulnerable populations at increased risk. So there are countries that do recognize that it still needs to be in place. Implementation is another issue.
So it sounds like COVID-19 is going to be with us for a while. And these recommendations are targeted to government officials. But what can people on the street take away and implement in their daily lives? Diana?
Well, so I think that the main message from the consensus was that the pandemic is not over. It continues to be a serious public health threat, and that the response to the pandemic is not going to be from any one entity. I think individuals, if they become more aware that, just building on what Dr. Lazarus just said, that this is not solely an individual responsibility, that we should all be looking to collaboration across governmental entities, across non-governmental entities, community-based organizations, you know, requesting, demanding, advocating for this collaboration, unified approach, and holding these different societal entities responsible for that, continuing to be vocal. I think that's really important. Up until now, at least in the United States, things have been very diverse, to put it lightly, in terms of the response to the pandemic, not only across the country in different state policies, but even, you know, at lower levels, regional and municipal, local levels. So I think if people come away feeling that this is a serious public health issue, it needs a collaborative response, and that it is really incumbent on sectors across society to work together, then I think, you know, there can be strong support for advocacy along those lines.
One point I'd like to add is that for the public to be fully collaborative in responding in ways that will help us stop the pandemic, I think we need to rebuild trust. There has been a lot of loss of trust between the public and government agencies, even public health agencies, and sometimes even a lack of trust in science. And we need to rebuild that. And we need to listen more. We need to be humble in saying when we don't know. We don't always know the right answers. The science is constantly developing. And to try as much as possible to be consistent and clear in our recommendations. And then finally, as I mentioned before, to be culturally responsive and culturally respectful. All of these elements together, hopefully, will rebuild trust where we may have lost it in the first phase of the pandemic.
And this research is a very good first step, I think, in rebuilding that trust. Who was involved in this research?
So the methodology we employed was called the Delphi study. And what's really important is indeed who's involved in this kind of research. Delphi is specifically about gathering experts in, you know, any number of topics to really deliberate and in a rigorous manner consider whether or not consensus can be reached on the topic. It's not a predetermined outcome that there's always going to be consensus. And so in this case, we brought together close to 400 experts around the world across 112 countries. And it was led by a core group, Drs. Lazarus and Elmohandas here today, together with two other individuals that together represent four continents. Okay, and from there, reached out to other experts so that we had a core group of 40 experts around the world. The process of Delphi requires that then a sort of iterative process of data collection occur ultimately, but in order to address the fact that this is a worldwide pandemic, this core group considered other experts around the world through, you know, their own work and context, but also engaged in the vast literature around COVID-19 to identify other experts. All told, that resulted in this panel of close to 400 experts. And it was informed by ongoing scientific results and policy activities around COVID, sort of the day-to-day changes that were occurring, that statements and recommendations related to COVID-19 were considered by the panel across three waves of data collection. So ultimately, it is indeed this multinational panel of experts that considered the literature and came to a high level of consensus around the steps necessary in order to try to end COVID as a public health threat, at least.
And to coordinate that many people, what was that process like?
It was challenging, to say the least.
Yeah, I'm sure.
We use a software called Qualtrics, but still people write a lot of emails. As a part of those three rounds where we voted, but people could also leave comments. And in the end, we had between the three rounds over 5,000 written comments. And there were some duplicates. Wow. There were some okay or nice jobs, but there were still a couple thousand comments we had to consider. So for the researchers listening in, the next time you get two or three peer reviewers giving you 15 or 20 comments, just remember, we had a couple thousand. And so that's why it often takes a long time. So yeah, I'd like to go to vote and, you know, revise. And a couple of weeks later, we go to the next round. But there was a lot of consideration. We also had a consensus meeting hosted by the UK-based think tank, Wilton Park. And we had a great team, both at CUNY and at IIS Global, of people assisting from the intern level to research assistants to PhD students, you know, who could really make sure we were tracking everything, doing due diligence to every comment, to every message.
And Nature is a very prestigious scientific journal, but it's not a health journal. So why publish this in Nature?
We're incredibly honored and humbled to be in Nature, I should say. I think I speak for everyone. But we chose Nature as our first choice because it is a multidisciplinary journal. We wanted to symbolize in everything we did from the multidisciplinary panel, you know, that included public health experts and infectious disease doctors and virologists, but also a lawyer, a philosopher, a mathematician, other people who could help us understand society. And in the same way, Nature addresses a whole range of scientific issues. We thought this would be well-placed there, both symbolically, but also because it's one of the most respected scientific journals.
We also believe that publishing this work in Nature allows for the widest readership. So it's more than symbolic. And we believe that the next response to the next phase of the pandemic needs to be multi-sectorial. We want, as Jeff just mentioned, we want the economists to be aware. We want the policymakers, the politicians. We want public service. We want science. We want media. We want the widest readership, and we want the widest response. And that is the core of this consensus report. The report in its core is rallying, as we said, a whole government, whole society approach. And so we would be preaching to the choir if we sequestered this in a journal where the readership was only amongst public health professionals or healthcare professionals, because the answer to the pandemic in the next phase cannot be only from that segment of academics and professionals.
Definitely. And so what are the next steps now that this publication is released?
Well, we're carrying out a widespread dissemination process. So we're presenting it at various meetings and conferences of all stripes, from COVID specific to a high level meeting in Brussels on migration and migrant health, to infectious disease societies, to regional public health meetings. We're very active on social media, sharing it, sharing key messages. We've been blogging about it. We have this podcast. We've had a lot of media attention, and that still continues. With so many authors, we've encouraged everyone to engage with the local media, the national and regional media, where they are. We're planning activities all the way, into 2023, so that we can keep this going. We'll need to think now, as a group, how we continue to work together on related issues and expanding this. But in terms of this concrete output, we have to remember there are still no comprehensive action plans or strategies, certainly not at the global or supranational level. So we'll be advocating for these recommendations to be taken up.
Well, congratulations on all the great work you've been doing and continue to do. So I like to always ask the guests on this podcast, and I'll ask all three of you here, what makes public health personal to you? I'll start with Diana.
So that's a great question. I would say probably two things. I came to the field of public health through a very circuitous route. And I, like many young people at the time, wasn't even aware of public health. In my upbringing, health was like healthcare. So it was actually through scientific journalism that I became a little frustrated with reporting on medical developments that didn't seem to have a social component to them. So public health, became a real passion for me a little later in life because of that part of it. And I would say that being a Latina, a New Yorker, as they say, I'm very much aware of the disparate experiences of my community, and not just with regard to public health, but just socially across the span. So just experiencing this pandemic as yet the next example of the disparate social and health experiences that Latino populations have really continues to inspire me to do this work.
Great. Ayman?
Well, again, like Diana, I practiced pediatrics for many years of my life. I would say for about 35 years in my life. And in mid-career in medicine, I did realize that approaching the problem only from a crisis mode, since I was in neonatal intensive care, it became very obvious to me that this was wasting a lot of resources when we could adopt at least partially a preventive approach. And that's what got me interested in public health and engaged me in public health at a stage in my career where I had already committed a lot of time and effort to building skills as an intensive care specialist in neonatal medicine. But I felt like my skill set was lacking. I dealt with the end product of reproduction. I realized how many of the mothers that that I had to care for or for their babies would have benefited so much from public health interventions at the community level and at the personal level. And through that lens, I embraced public health as a parallel career in, I would say probably at that time in my early 40s, and never let go of it, and as such have had a dual career, both in medicine and in public health. And to be honest with you, now I dedicate my life entirely to public health as I see its importance.
Right. And Jeff?
I'm clearly influenced by the decade I spent at the World Health Organization, because I see health as a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being, and not merely the absence of disease or infirmity. And in order to achieve that for everyone, we have to take a public health approach. And that's why I'm focused on public health, which sometimes means you're a jack of all trades and a master of none. But like Dr. Omohande said, we're kind of operating on populations and not individuals. We have far-reaching policies that we can influence. And this pandemic has clearly shown that there's an important central and paramount place for public health, because when we don't ensure public health, the entire fabric of society as we know it can unravel, economies can be shut down, and we've seen massive morbidity and mortality, which still continues.
Absolutely. Well, thank you all for being guests on the podcast.
Thank you. It was fun.
Thanks.
Thank you for having us.
To find out more about the COVID-19 consensus statement in Nature and read it for yourself, go to cunysph.me/nature. As we approach the holidays, I want to wish you all a healthy and happy holiday season and a joyous new year. I appreciate you listening to our show, which is officially 1 year old and going strong. The Making Public Health Personal podcast is now available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, Audible, and on our YouTube channel. So please share, like, and subscribe. To find out more about the CUNY Graduate School of Public Health and Health Policy, you can visit sph.cuny.edu or connect with us on social media. We're on LinkedIn, Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube. Just search CUNY SPH. This is your host, Laura Mioli-Farragon, signing off. And while public health has a global impact, that doesn't mean we can't make it personal.